KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is you.
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of October 2018. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Largy with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Nathan Bernier is away this week, but here's what we've got for you. How Beto O'Rourke's message on racial injustice is resonating with black voters in Texas.
I think that he's speaking to issues that hit at the core of issues that are facing black people.
Austin looks to revamp its rules about sleeping and camping in public.
The shelters are full. They have nowhere else to go. And they can't help but meet their basic human need for shelter in public.
And a new film aimed at preserving black history on Austin's east side.
They just had remarkable stories of how life was back in the day and growing up on East 12th Street.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke has overwhelming support among black voters in his bid to oust Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. In fact, a recent poll found 97% of black voters surveyed favored O'Rourke. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports that support is growing mostly because of the issues the campaign has decided not to shy away from.
There's this video of Beto O'Rourke that Ted Cruz tweeted not too long ago. It shows O'Rourke standing in front of a crowd of African Americans in a church in Dallas. The crowd was on their feet cheering as O'Rourke talked about what happened to Botham Jean, a black man who had been fatally shot in his own home by a white Dallas police officer.
How will we continue to lose the lives of unarmed black men in the United States of America?
While O'Rourke condemned the shooting and said it pointed to a larger problem that faces black people in America, Cruz has said he's weary of jumping to conclusions about what happened. In his tweet sharing the video, Cruz wrote, in Beto O'Rourke's own words, as if O'Rourke made this huge misstep. But if you talk to black voters, this wasn't a misstep. It was a breath of fresh air.
I think that he's speaking to issues that hit at the core of issues that are facing black people.
That's Latrice Cook. She's the executive director and founder of the Melge Center, which works with people who have been incarcerated. She's not surprised at all to hear that O'Rourke is doing very well among black voters. Cook says O'Rourke is talking about police violence and race, which are the kinds of things politicians typically tread carefully around.
People are afraid to talk about what's going on right now. People are a little bit more cautious about people's feelings there, and especially when it comes to this, because it is so much tension right now.
Like the debate over professional football players kneeling during the national anthem in protest of police violence. When asked about this issue during a campaign event, O'Rourke said this.
And I can think of nothing more American than to peacefully stand up or take a knee for your rights anytime, anywhere, any place.
When he said that, I was like, yes. Oh, yeah. Like, I jumped. I was like, yes.
That's Grant Loveless. He's a student and black activist in Austin. He says he appreciates that O'Rourke has acknowledged that life is harder for black people in America than it is for privileged white Americans.
Because we have to jump hurdles. We have to go in trenches of water just to get where we want to. Whereas other people would just have to walk along and say, oh, well, my dad's the CEO. I got the job. And that's when institutional power does come in.
In fact, during his debate with Ted Cruz, Beto O'Rourke was asked about a DWI arrest when he was young. O'Rourke said he made a mistake and was grateful to have been afforded a second chance in life.
What I do know is that as a white man in this country, there's a privilege that I enjoy that many African-American men and women do not.
Latrice Cook thinks the way O'Rourke is talking about these issues is resonating with black voters like her. She says she thinks O'Rourke knows he's probably upsetting some white voters, but she's glad he's taking that risk.
I think that one of the things that we failed to do just as a society is talk about it and talk about things in real time and talk about it in a way that is not edited or where you're using cautionary language.
But Gabrielle Prichard with Austin Justice Coalition, which works on issues of racial justice, says it would be a bigger deal if O'Rourke didn't talk about this. She says it's 2018 and race is at the core of political divisions.
I think it would have been a huge misstep and just a huge letdown if this hadn't been part of the narrative at all.
Prichard says as a Black woman, she agrees that O'Rourke is saying all the right things, but she also wants to see details and a plan to address these issues. And she says people need to also hold O'Rourke accountable if he doesn't do or say the right thing.
There's kind of this whole Beto will save everything, but we also have to hold these people accountable. So if they say something that you're not quite on board with, making sure you call them out.
But so far, the campaign hasn't gotten pushback from Black voters. Instead, polls are only showing increasing support for O'Rourke. Peck Young, a professor with Austin Community College and a longtime Democratic strategist, says it is not surprising Black voters are supporting O'Rourke in large numbers. He says they're the backbone of the Democratic Party. In fact, he says he's more surprised that the party as a whole isn't reaching out to Black voters as consistently as O'Rourke.
The problem is that a lot of the leadership around him in other parts of the state are still a part of this, we got to find a swing voter. Well, when 50 to 60% of the voters vote brand, which is straight ticket voting, your first job is to find those people and be sure they're motivated on your side.
But the O'Rourke campaign says this is an important part of his efforts to make sure communities feel heard and understood. The campaign is purposefully not shying away from these issues because they believe it's what people care about. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
One of the many issues the Austin City Council plans to tackle over the next year is an overhaul of city ordinances that relate to homelessness. But it won't be easy. KUT's Andrew Weber reports on how federal courts could inform and complicate that effort.
In the last 3 years, the Austin Police Department has handed out more than 10,000 tickets downtown for things like panhandling, sitting on sidewalks, or setting up camps. I recently visited one of those camps with Austin Police Assistant Chief Justin Newsom. We met at APD headquarters. We didn't have to go far.
Sleeping like a baby.
We're literally right out of the gate at the northwest corner of the building under the Waller Creek Bridge at 8th Street. Five people are there sleeping on cots or in chairs.
We'd talk to them if they're awake, but I don't really want to wake them up. You know, every time I ever come down here, the people are as nice as they can be. And you'll see when we get over the arch that homeless people are some of the most kind. Hey, man. How you doing?
All right.
You okay?
How are you?
Didn't want to wake
62-year-old Alan Thomas is one of those folks sleeping here. We talked to Alan for a bit. He says he's been homeless for 15 or 20 years, but he doesn't really want to be interviewed. So we let him get back to his nap. Newsom could have ticketed Alan and the other people sleeping here, but he says most officers don't, unless there's a complaint from a citizen. And more often than not, APD breaks up a camp, then...
We have nowhere to send them. And so they go somewhere and create a new camp, which will eventually be a new complaint, which will require us to respond to that citizen complaint at some point and break that camp up. And then where do we send them? So it's just this revolving door of there's no place for these people to exist. And until we can figure that piece out, we're always going to be chasing our tail.
But that's not to say people aren't cited for doing this. They are. Each ticket costs anywhere from $160 to $210, and most of the citations go unpaid. Only 31 have been paid outright according to court records, and the vast majority result in arrest warrants for defendants. Newsom says it's a fine line.
We walk such a balancing act every day. You know, if we do too much, people say that we're just criminalizing homelessness and we're unempathetic and we don't want to help anybody, we just want to punish. And if we don't do enough, we get the other side saying that we're all just a bunch of liberals and we don't want to enforce laws and we're advocates for the homeless when we should be, you know, advocates for the law, you know? And so we can't win. The police can't win in this situation. We really can't.
Austin's not alone. Cities across the country have been reexamining these kinds of so-called quality of life ordinances, and they've been sued for them because plaintiffs argue they're unconstitutional. A few weeks ago, one of those challenges succeeded in a federal appeals court, effectively striking down bans on sleeping or camping in public in Boise, Idaho. That decision only affects cities in 9 western states, but the ruling has given new life to a case over Houston's camping ban that's been working its way through the courts for the past year, a case led by the ACLU. Tricia Trujillo is the attorney arguing the case.
The legal theory of relief that the homeless plaintiffs in Boise pushed is the same theory of relief that our clients are pushing here in Houston, which is that the shelters are full, they have nowhere else to go, and they can't help but meet their basic human need for shelter in public. They really have no other choice but to be trying to shelter themselves with things like temporary structures or tents.
Trujillo's argument isn't new. It stems from a 1962 Supreme Court decision, Robinson v. California, that more or less made it illegal to punish someone for something related to their so-called status. That precedent was further sharpened in a case that started right here in Austin in 1966.
On December 19, 1966, the appellant was charged in the Corporation Court of the City of Austin, Texas, with the offense of being intoxicated in a public place.
Austinite Leroy Powell appealed his arrest for public drunkenness all the way to the Supreme Court. His lawyers argued that he was arrested for being an alcoholic who happened to be drunk in public, not for mischievous or criminal conduct. He'd been arrested 73 times from 1949 to 1966 in Travis County, all but one for public intoxication. His lawyers argued his history was proof he couldn't control his behavior, that alcoholism was a disease. He was arrested for his status as an alcoholic, they argued, not his behavior. Attorney David Robinson Jr. argued against that claim for the state of Texas.
That principle has few stopping places.
What is the behavior here? This is a condition. This man didn't commit an assault and battery or wasn't guilty of even disorderly conduct. What's the behavior? I suppose, sitting down or lying down. Or maybe stumbling.
That would be behavior.
But that's not criminal behavior if you're sober, is it?
Well, I suppose if one lies across the sidewalk, that would likely be...
Well, he wasn't arrested for obstructing the sidewalk, was he?
No, Your Honor.
What was his behavior?
According to the record...
It was a condition, wasn't it? He didn't do anything that wouldn't be perfectly legal to do if he were sober, did he?
Well, I assume that's correct.
Potter Stewart, who you just heard on the tape there, and some of his fellow justices were convinced that Powell's conditions were just that, conditional. He couldn't control it, and if given a chance, he wouldn't find himself in the position in which he was. So prosecuting him under state law would be cruel and unusual punishment. The rest of the court didn't buy that argument, finding Powell was drunk in public and that the behavior violated state law. But Stewart and 3 other justices dissented. They wrote you shouldn't punish a person for something that's part and parcel of their identity or their present circumstances. And lawyers cited that dissent in cases involving circumstances like homelessness, namely the Boise case and the case in Houston, which is heading back to trial after the Boise decision. Trujillo says a decision on Houston's camping ordinance could take years, but if the court sides with her plaintiffs, Austin's ordinances would be invalidated too. That's because the 2,100 homeless people here only have 2 major emergency shelters to choose from in the downtown area.
When you have a situation like you have there in Austin, where you have many more people than can possibly fit in the shelter, it's just unconstitutionally cruel to punish them for doing the unavoidable result of being homeless.
Earlier this year, the Austin City Council considered revising its ordinances banning camping and sleeping in public after a series of audits showed enforcing them was onerous for chronically homeless Austinites trying to get housed. But those conversations petered out before the council's summer break. David Green is a spokesperson for the city. He says the council will revisit the issue in the coming months.
We've had a series of meetings with various stakeholders on all sides of the issue, and we kind of decided that we needed to take a step back and try and assess a good, comprehensive way forward. So we haven't done that yet.
One of those stakeholders is Assistant Police Chief Newsom. He says in the year he's been Assistant Chief downtown, he's spent more time on homelessness than anything else. But until he's told otherwise, he's going to enforce what's on the books. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The 17th Austin City Limits Music Festival kicks off in Zilker Park this weekend. Its long run often draws comparisons to Austin's first big festival, Aquafest. Loretta Spangle asked about Aquafest for our AT Explained project. She wanted to know, whatever happened to it, and why did it stop? KUT's Jimmy Moss has the story.
If you've never heard of it, the Austin Aqua Festival was a big deal. And we're not talking just stature. It was a big, sprawling celebration that at different points in its history had events from the Hill Country to Bergstrom. It was so big, it needed its own quasi-navy to command it. It was called the Admiral's Club. Here's Vice Commodore Joe Wells describing the first fest in 1962.
The theme of this Aqua Festival is fun for everyone. Particularly for those who love the water, we have a canoe race, a ski tournament, fishing contest in our Highland Lakes, and a big water parade.
The ethnic nights, there was Czech night, German night, you know, Latino night.
Jet ski race, there was that stuff over on the east side, the speedboat races, and there was, you know, there was always all kinds of stuff.
There'll also be two other parades, an enormous land parade, and a homecoming parade for our 49th Division.
There were air shows, pet parades, something called kite skiing, and bowling.
From Highland Lanes in Austin, Texas, the USA Network presents the Professional Bowlers Tour. And tonight, it's the $125,000 AquaFest Mr. Gaddy's Open.
Also heard there were Ernie Gamage and Leah Meckling.
So it was really, I think, a great example of Austin being Austin and trying to be inclusive and really celebrate our cultural diversity.
Aqua Festival was started in 1962 by the Austin Chamber of Commerce as a way to get people to visit the city during the summer. The Admiral's Club, made up of civic and business leaders, took a throw everything at the wall to see what sticks approach. They changed up the program from year to year. To lure national television, they would trot out celebrities to promote events, including TV's Batman, Adam West, and Ed McMahon, twice. They would dream up sporting events like drag boat races. But those boat races created a problem for Eastside residents. Noise and indifference to the needs of the neighborhood prompted Latino activists and allies to demand the festival be moved. After years of protests and violent arrests of demonstrators in 1978, the city council dumped the boat race and moved AquaFest away from Festival Beach.
The city displayed total disregard for the neighborhood over there and the residents. They just clearly didn't care. And it took, you know, the brown berets and priests from churches really causing a hubbub and protesting and getting arrested before people paid attention.
But while events would come and go, AquaFest nights were usually filled with music.
In the 60s, 1967, the band I was in won the Austin Aqua Festival Battle of the Bands, which was a big deal.
A picture of me. You know that life.
Ernie Gamage was the front man for the Sweethearts, heard here, the winning band from 1967. He says music became a bigger focus after the festival moved to Auditorium Shores.
It gave the festival a chance to really open up and spread out and have big stages and have multiple stages. And that's when I think it took on the appearance of a true music festival. And, you know, I can't think of it in any other terms but that it was a precursor to ACL.
Big stars at the time started to make AquaFest a stop on their tours. Ringo Starr, Dwight Yoakam, Kenny Loggins, Chuck Berry, Joe Walsh, and Dolly Parton. It was the bigger payouts for those stars and falling attendance that dealt the festival a double whammy. Gamage would know. In 1993, he became the executive director of AquaFest.
My job, as I saw it, was to keep it from hemorrhaging money, which it had been, and to turn it around so it would be profitable and to continue. And unfortunately, I was not able to do that.
After the 1994 festival, the city stopped supporting AquaFest. Gamage and his professional staff were laid off. The offices were packed up and closed. But AquaFest managed a few more years with only volunteer organizers. Those years were all financial failures. The plug was finally pulled before they could even try another run in 1998.
Every life has you know, operates on a bell curve, including our own lives. And Aqua Festival had a bell curve. There was a part, you know, when it started out, it was very small at Festival Beach, and it grew and grew. And then the peak, really, the big top of the bell curve is when it first went and was enriched by all of that space available to it at Auditorium Shores. And then it dwindled and died.
By then, Austin had outgrown the Aqua Festival's purpose. It no longer needed one event to bring people to town in just the summer. Riding that first tech boom of the 90s, it was vibrant year-round. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
There's much more in our AT Explained project at atexplained.org. You can subscribe to the AT Explained podcast there if you missed any of the more than 40 episodes we've produced so far. And you can ask your own question. It might be the next one we answer. That's all at atexplained.org. Saturday marks Austin's third annual Return and Discover Festival. The event brings together local musicians, restaurants, and businesses to celebrate the history and heritage of the neighborhood near 12th and Chacon Streets. The City of Austin and the East 12th Street Merchants Association will also debut a short film at the festival. It's called Reflections on a Legacy, East 12th Street. It's part of a broader effort to record the history of this rapidly changing part of East Austin.
Back in the day, 12th Street was our main business area. And Austin was small enough where basically all the families knew each other.
Well, I saw 12th Street as persons were independent. They were not dependent on the man.
Hey everybody, my name is Fumi Ogunro, aka Fum Fum Ko, a filmmaker here in Austin, Texas. So, Reflections on the Legacy, East 12th Street, is a documentary that captures the oral history of the rich Black culture of East 12th Street. I'm from Austin, and I spent a lot of time in East Austin, so I've seen the many changes and the gentrification and a lot of the Black people being pushed out, and the culture is leaving as well. But the great thing about this documentary is that we focus on the richness of Black culture. The oral history really goes into detail about how vibrant the communities were. So this documentary was almost a form of healing because I was learning so much about the richness of Black East Austin. We interviewed three Native Black East Austinites, Volma Overton, Diane Lang, and Margaret Wright. And they are very involved in the community and have been in East Austin their entire lives. They just had remarkable stories of how life was back in the day and growing up on East 12th Street and the grocery stores they used to go to, like Yates Grocery Store. They talk a lot about the Harlem Theater, which was the Black theater here in East Austin. And they talk a lot about the famous chili burgers they would get for 25 cents. And so these three Native East Austinites that we interviewed really gave us a great picture of how vibrant the businesses were on East 12th Street and throughout East Austin, and how they didn't need anybody. They didn't need the white man. They were able to build a vibrant and rich, economically prosperous community amongst themselves. As the cinematographer and editor for the project, I learned a lot about the history of East 12th Street. The day of the interviews, I was astonished by the amount of information I didn't know about East Austin. I feel like there are a lot of newcomers here that see East Austin. They see all these hipster bars and all this, like, hipster culture. But really, behind all that was a really vibrant, rich Black culture that was the core of East Austin. And it was beautiful listening to the stories. I felt happy because a lot of times, you know, if I'm driving around East Austin, you know, you see everything changing. I start to feel a little bit sad. But when I was doing this documentary, I felt happy. And I was amazed by the history. And I was happy that we were documenting it so that we can share it with others.
That was Funmi Ogunro. She's a cinematographer and editor for the film Reflections on a Legacy, East 12th Street. The documentary debuts Saturday at 11:30 a.m. at Mission Possible Church on Chacon Street. The story was produced by KUT's Saida Hassan. That's KUT Weekend for the first weekend of October 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or you can just ask on Twitter. I'm @MattLargy. Or you can ask this podcast's regular host, Nathan Bernier. He's @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Largy with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. Nathan Bernier will be back next week. And then,